So it's nice to be here talking to you all for the first time now. As you know, I'll be talking about gender-aware data collection, measurement and valuation of household production. Now, we have been discussing about this paradigmic shift in macroeconomics, that it is becoming more realistic, more holistic, more relevant. In order to support that, we also have to have feminist methodologies to analyze the data, to collect the data, to use the data. So in order to support paradigmic shift in macroeconomics, there is a need for paradigmic shift in data collection or statistical paradigm also. Because unless you do that shift, you cannot match with the requirements of the new economic analysis that we are talking about. And in that context, time-use surveys are very important. I mean, time-use surveys is not whole and soul as such, but they provide the kind of inputs which are important in the new statistical paradigm that we are talking about. And I'll be discussing primarily that in this session. So this presentation primarily deals with what is paradigmic shift in feminist methodologies in terms of data collection, data analysis, and data use. And then in that context, what do time-use data tell us? Application of time-use data, including measurement and valuation of household production, and then major issues and areas of concern in this area, in this subject. Now, we all know that statistical paradigm is defined something like this, that the mission of most national statistical systems is to provide reliable, timely, credible social and economic statistics to assist decision-making within and outside the government and to stimulate research and promote informed debate relating to conditions of people. This is something which is common everywhere. All national statistical organizations try to do this and collect data on this. But the interpretation of this mission or the translation of this mission into actual practice is not something which is very positive because it depends on how they look at the socioeconomic life of people because they're supposed to produce data on that, but how people look at it is very important. In that sense, the statistical paradigm, which is existing in most national statistical offices right now, covers primarily three areas. One is UNSNA, that means United Nations Systems of National Accounts. Whatever is covered into that is covered in data systems. So whenever you have to produce your national accounts, you need those data, and those data are produced. It could be agriculture, industry, trade, services, whatever. So all those data we collect, that's one set of data which is collected. Second is well-being of people, because we also think in terms of poverty, human development, health, nutrition, and so on and so forth. So that is also collected. And the third is other areas of relevance according to the perception of people. And perception of statistician or perception of policymakers primarily includes something like environmental data or some other data. So what is happening right now is that in spite of the wide range of data collection, three major biases are emerging in our data system. The first is market bias or economic bias, because you are focusing on SNA, national income, economic or market economy, or what is included in UNSNA. As you all know, that the definition of SNA has expanded recently to include non-market production also. So United Nations, I'm sure you are aware about UNSNA systems, all of you. So United Nations has this system of national accounts to uniformize national accounting system all over the world, and that's why they have developed, they have evolved a concept of SNA, and the boundaries of SNA have recently expanded to include non-market production. But non-market production of goods and not of services. And that is the way you collect the data. So this is one thing that you have market bias, and non-market collection is not done in many economies except for agriculture. With the result that the bias is primarily on market economy and market production, or economic bias, one can say. The second bias is sociocultural bias. What the policymakers and statisticians consider as relevant, as important to understand socio-cultural problems with the economy is included in that, and there is a male bias over there. And the third bias, which is more important, is which is equally important, is measurability bias. That means whatever you can measure, whatever you can quantify, you include, and whatever you cannot, you don't include. And this is through conventional data collection methods. Not any innovative new methods, but conventional data collection methods, you know, the kind of surveys and other kind of data collection methods which officials use. So that is measurability bias, and you can collect only those things which are measurable. With the result that the database that we have right now does not address the requirements of feminist economics. First is it is partial and incomplete, because it doesn't include the total economy, it includes just a part of the economy, and the other part of economy, unpaid economy, is totally left out. Second, it is distorted, because it is not complete, and it includes only those things which are relevant and which are quantifiable, just pick up those things, with the result that whatever you get is distorted. It's not really holistic, healthy kind of a data system, but it's distorted. And thirdly, it is inadequate. Now, inadequate in two, three senses. Firstly, it is inadequate because it doesn't give information, collect information about the conventional data macroeconomic variables. In the sense that we'll see very soon that the data on GDP, data on workforce. Now, the kind of methods which are used in data collection of these major macro variables are not really able to capture this data adequately. We all know that, and we know that there's a big scope for improvement, and maybe time use can help us there in some ways. Second is that gender-relevant issues are not included in that, and gender-disaggregated data also are not that. And third is that unpaid work is totally left out, because unpaid work doesn't happen, is not covered under any conventional national database as such. So this kind of a database is far from adequate for us, and that's why we have to think in terms of improving the database. Now, if you look at human activities can be divided into three parts, basically. One is SNA activities, that means the activities which are included in national income accounts. Second is non-SNA activities, which are included, which are unpaid activities, which are not included in SNA. The first kind of activities are included in production boundary of UNSNA. There is a concept of production boundary, and it's included. The second kind is included in general production boundary, which means those goods and services which are not personalized and can be bought and sold in the market, which have a potential of buying and selling in the market, are included in that. That's unpaid work. And third is personal services, like, you know, service activities which are sleeping, watching TV, and those kind of things. Now, non-SN activities can be broadly divided into three categories. One is upkeep of household. That means household management, cleaning, washing, shopping for the family, et cetera, et cetera. Second is care, direct care-related activities, care of children, care of the old, care of the disabled, which is going on in the household. And the third is community services or voluntary services. These are also free services, and that's why they also are not included in national income. And personal services are, again, can be divided into different categories. First is personal, means personal hygiene, personal care, et cetera. Second is human capital formation in personal services, through personal services, like studying, reading, exercising, etc., which builds up your human capital, but that is something which you cannot delegate, and that's why it's covered into personal services. And third is the kind of entertainment and those things which you watch, etc. So these are the kind of activities which are included. The fact is that all these activities are relevant in any economy. Firstly, because these activities, there is no watertight compartments between these activities. If something is done within the household in a developing country, it is in the market in developed countries. Or same way in business cycles also they fluctuate. So sometimes when the incomes are rising, employment is rising, people buy things from the market. But when employment is falling, everything's falling down, those activities get into the household activity. So between non-SNA and SNA, this movement takes place depending on the different situations. Similarly, personal services also, situation may change when technology develops, for example. You know, for example, giving birth to a child, extreme case. Now it is something which is available in the market because you can hire people for doing this kind of a job. So there is no watertight compartment between these activities. This is something very important to consider. And secondly, what is important is that these activities are interlinked in that sense. But what is important is that they impact on macro policies, and macro policies impact on these activities. So not only SN activities are impacted by macro policies, but also non-SN activities are impacted by macro policies. For example, let's talk about fiscal deficits. To meet target for fiscal deficits, expenditure, public expenditure is curtailed under neoliberal policies. When fiscal expenditure is curtailed, then health, educational services, frequently in many countries it has happened that social expenditure declines. And when social expenditure declines and social things become expensive, those activities go within the household. And that's why women carry on those activities. Now, we do not have any data on that as to how many women are doing this job, what is the burden of work of women increasing in the process, etc. But this macro policy is definitely impacted on this non-SN activities. Financial crisis, which is going on right now. Now, studies have shown that women's burden of work has increased, unpaid work burden has increased. But there is no data, there is no policy that addresses these kind of issues. And that's why these are the issues which are relevant for macro policy formulation, for monitoring macro policies, etc., are not included in data collection. And that is something which is very important. So, in other words, these are relevant because all of them together contribute to well-being of people. Secondly, these are not watertight compartments, they are interlinked. Thirdly, macro policies impact on them, and they also impact on macro policies. And fourthly, that these activities are hierarchical and gendered activities, in the sense that SN activities are primarily done by men, non-SN activities are almost depending on different countries, of course, but 70-80% activities are done by women. And there is a hierarchy between paid and unpaid work. Paid work in the market has a different kind of things. Unpaid work in the home has a different kind of environment. There is the unpaid work has dead-end jobs, there is drudgery, there is low productivity. Frequently in developing countries, they spend a lot of time on that, etc. While paid work in the market is addressed by policies, there is a technology, skill training, improved productivity, design, et cetera, going on. So there is a hierarchy of paid and unpaid work, and women are in the unpaid work hierarchy, and they are usually carrying out the drudgery and unpaid part of it. That's something which is very important. So the hierarchical part of it and gender part of it also is something very important. In that context, I think it's important that we collect information for all the three kinds of activities to understand the full macroeconomy. And as we have been seeing for the last 2 years, that 2 days, that macroeconomy consists of both paid and unpaid work, and we have to get full picture of paid and unpaid work. Otherwise, we will not be able to use the data for understanding the new macroeconomics we are talking about. Now, for that, we have time use surveys. And time use surveys are of different kinds. You know, it's not just one variety. What do time use surveys tell us? Let's see. First of all, they tell us about, they provide comprehensive information on how people spend their time on different activities. That is SNA, non-SNA, and personal activities. They provide comprehensive information. And if you collect data for 24 hours, or for, which can be processed into 1 week kind of a thing, then weekly information on how men and women spend their time on different activities is something very important to understand, and that's something which is provided by time use. They are quantitative summaries of how individuals spend their time, allocate their time over a specified period. And there are three major components of time use data. One is they provide background information. Now, background information is provided when there is an independent survey conducted, then there is a separate background information. But when there is a modular survey conducted, then the rest of the questionnaire, apart from the module, I'll just explain how it works. You know, there are basically three, four kinds of time use surveys. One is an independent, full-fledged survey, which is conducted independently by a country in an independent manner, without linking that up with any other survey. So there you have this background schedule where you collect information on household and individuals, then schedule on time use, and third is context variable. This is something very important. For example, if I am working, then where am I working? What kind of work am I doing? What kind of technology I'm using? Those data also are collected. Now, second kind of surveys are modular surveys, that you have a labor force survey and you have a module of time use, or you have a household expenditure survey and there is a module of time use, or you can have any other survey, investment survey, and you can have a module of time use, etc. So it's a modular survey. At the end of the survey, there is a module which is put up, and that modular survey is another kind of survey. Third is that, you know, as and when required, you can have small-scale focus surveys. For example, we are doing a survey right now to understand the impact of crisis on a small region, on a selected sector. So in that area, we are trying to find out what is the impact of that particular crisis on paid and unpaid work of women. So it could be, time use surveys could be of different kinds. Now, Valera will discuss more about it, but what I'm trying to say here is that they provide comprehensive information not only on the time use as such, but also about the background and the context of the time use. In what context time use? For example, production is taking place, and is it for sale or is it for self-consumption? An activity is carried out, is it paid or is it unpaid? So those context variables are also there, which are relevant, which add to the information, richness of the information. Now, if you see the brief history of time use surveys, it's really very interesting. You know, when the surveys started, they started in the early 90s in a very different manner. It was just to understand the living conditions of working class families and lifestyle of people. So how they are spending their time, what they are doing, those kind of things, basically, that was the interest. Later on, a variety of objectives are added. For example, when people are commuting, then how much they are commuting, how much time they are commuting, what is the impact of new technology on farming population? This is something which USA did in 1920, first time use survey that USA conducted. Then in 60s and 70s, they were used for mass media. This was primarily in Korea and Japan, where they had time use surveys exclusively, and they were promoted by media organizations to understand as to what is the spare time, when we can have a particular program which will have maximum viewership or maximum listening people, etc., etc. So it was used for that, and then it was used also for transportation planning. Then in the 70s, when women's movement came into the picture, it became important that, you know, in order to understand unpaid work of women and their contribution to the economy, well-being of economy, time use surveys are utilized. So that was another focus given. And when developing countries entered into the time use era, time use field in 1990s, and one more focus was given, one more addition was made, and that is how many people are really contributing to labor force or workforce. Because the conventional surveys, labor force surveys, were not adequate to capture the informal work and the scattered, sporadic, uncertain, short-term work which were carried out by people. And that's why they thought that time use survey could be a good tool. And that's why a large number of developing countries entered into time use primarily to collect data, information on getting improved estimates of workforce. So that was another thing. And now, of course, recently, and of course, these people were, developing countries were also interested in understanding the issues in poverty and human development through time use. And now, as we all know, that there is also a very big understanding coming up that time use data can help in understanding macroeconomics, functioning of macroeconomics, and how macro policies impact on time use, and how unpaid work impacts on macro policies. How do you design macro policies? How do you monitor macro policies? For that, you require time use, because time use give us full picture of the impact of macro policies on different sections of the population, within SNA, outside SNA also. So you can see that over time, the uses of time use have expanded, and now time use has become a very important tool to understand different aspects of socioeconomic life of people. Now, time use provide improved data on macroeconomic aggregates. And macroeconomic aggregates also in conventional sense. For example, as we said about the workforce, if you want improved estimates of workforce, you require time use. Now, this is not only for developing countries, because there is a realization in developed countries also that when flexible employment is increasing in the labor market, when different work time arrangements are happening in the labor market, in order to understand the nature of work, you require time use. So what is the flexibility that's happening? When people are working, what time are they working? Is it compressed week, or is it part-time work, or is it scattered work, or is it home-based work, or what kind of work it is? So time use provides this information about the kind of workforce characteristics, which is not provided by conventional surveys. So it is in the sense of improving the conventional workforce data, time use contribute. Same way, conventional GDP also is improved through time use. Because as OECD report has pointed out, there are three major limitations of GDP data in different countries, including developing countries. One is that it does not include subsistence work. A large number of work is carried out in a subsistence manner, but that is not included because we don't have information. And most of the subsistence work is such where labor part is very important. And if you collect information as to how people spend time on this subsistence work, maybe you can multiply it by wage rate. We'll see valuation, how it's done later on. And then you can estimate the value of subsistence work in your GDP. So subsistence work, which is officially included in the SNA boundary, in the SNA production boundary now, can be estimated through time use. Same way with the informal sector. You know, several countries estimate GDP of informal sector in different ways. You know, they try to find out how many people are working. Then they carry out survey about the overall average productivity of the workers, and then multiply the average productivity by the number of workers in that particular sector and calculate the value of the contribution of that informal sector. Because in the absence of other data, many countries do that. But if you do not have accurate data as to how many people are working in that particular informal sector, then your GDP is not adequate. Even conventional sense, GDP will not be correct. So time use will provide improved estimates of conventional GDP also, because it will provide better information about the workforce engaged in different scattered informal sectors in the economy. And of course, if you're talking about the new macroeconomics, the total workforce consists of SNA and non-SNA workers, and time use provides that information. And if you're talking about new macroeconomics, total GDP, total well-being of the economy is also available through time use, because it provides information about the contribution made by the paid work SNA, as well as contribution made by non-SNA. In other words, if you want to improve your macroeconomic aggregates in the conventional sense, as well as in the feminist economic sense, then time use is very important. Another major contribution of time use that it provides information on all forms of work. Now, we have been hearing about this for quite some time, you know, PFA, Beijing Conference, Platform for Action in the Beijing Conference, UNDP, HDR 1995, 1993 UNSNA, all of them have suggested that all countries should collect information on all forms of work, remunerated as well as non-remunerated work that is carried out in different economies. It has been suggested again and again, and the major tool, or the major, right now the only tool that can do is time use surveys. So time use surveys can provide that information. So if you want to have total picture of all forms of work carried out in an economy, then time use is the thing. And this difficult sectors, which are important for us to use time use, are informal work, subsistence work, unpaid domestic work, and voluntary work. These are the forms of work which are important in all forms of work, but for which we do not have any data in the conventional sense. Now, as far as workforce is concerned, I think it's very important. You know, the tragedy is that though large number of countries are developing countries have entered into time use data, time use surveys to collect information on informal sector, so far not a single country has been able to estimate informal employment through time use. because there are many methodological conceptual problems involved over here. But there is a possibility, and we have written, Jack Chance and I had written a paper on this as to how time use helps in accessing informal sector data. For example, first of all, why is not workforce estimated accurately in developing countries? One is that there are biases on the side of women, because women don't consider their unpaid work as work, and that's why they don't report it as work. Secondly, there are some conceptual problems also. For example, if somebody is cooking for hired workers, hired agricultural workers, and also cooking for the family, then that cooking conceptually needs to be divided into two kinds of cooking. One will be in the unpaid work, the other one would be in the market work. But that conceptual clarity is not there, and that those kind of data collection is not happening. Again, informal work is scattered, as I said earlier, uncertain, seasonal, sporadic, intermittent, and with the result that to capture this data through conventional service, it's extremely difficult. So one major way of doing this is through time use survey, because time use survey captures all this work because it collects information without any bias, or almost without any bias, because they ask, how do you spend your time? And you report, how do you spend your time? And you account for 24 hours, for example. Then that provides information about how do you spend your time. So if you have good classification system, then you can classify this data into SNR and SN, et cetera, and you can come out with the estimates for informal sector. Subsistence sector is another sector which helps in time. Because if you have a context variable as to whether the work is paid or unpaid, and you say that this is, or it's for, sorry, whether the work is for market or for sale, for self-consumption, then that context variable will give you information about self-consumption or subsistence work, and that will help us in collecting the data on how much time is spent on subsistence work, and you can value that. Flexibility of work, as I said, work is flexible, and the nature of flexibility can be captured through time use survey. Multiple jobs, you know, in developing countries, large number of people do multiple jobs. They may be a cultivator in the morning, later on they become agricultural workers, or then they go and collect fuel for the water, or they do some handicraft sometimes. Sometimes they go to the market and sell. So multiple jobs are happening, and conventional surveys collect information about 1, 2, 3 jobs. But the kind of multiplicity of jobs which is happening in these countries is not captured through conventional surveys. The time use can do that. Then multiple simultaneous work. Simultaneous work is another thing which is happening in all countries, developing as well as developed countries. Like, for example, woman may be taking care of child. At the same time, she may be attending to her domestic chores. And both the things are happening. She cannot go out because there is a child to take care of. But at the same time, she's doing a large number of other activities. So this multiplicity of work which is happening cannot be captured through conventional surveys, and that's why we need time use. In other words, time use provides information about workforce estimates. I mean, it provides not only improved estimates, but it also provides information about the characteristics of the workforce in terms of the flexibility, in terms of their informality, in terms of their multiplicity, and in terms of simultaneous work. So this additional information is available only through time use, and that's why time use provides better information on workforce. Now, why developing countries have not been able to capture this? This is because you have to use the right kind of context variable to assess as to whether the activity is for market or for self-consumption. You also have to collect information about for whom. That means, are you doing this work for a corporate sector, for government, for cooperative, or for a small enterprise, household enterprise, etc. So if you have context of for whom, if you have context of other kind that sale on this thing, then those context variable will be able to help you in capturing this, which is not done by in many countries. Another thing is that you require kind of classification which helps you in understanding this. And this classification has to match with the classification which is used for labor force classification. Unless you match the classification, this additional information cannot be absorbed in the mainstream, and you can't really say as to how much is the addition and what is the contribution of the informal sector. But that classification is another issue which is very important. I'm sure Valeria will discuss that issue later on. So what is happening is that they are not able to capture estimates of workforce adequately. Now, one more thing which time use can help is in valuation of unpaid work. Now, unpaid work which is carried out within homes is a part of macroeconomy. And we have to collect this information because this information is something very important to understand human capital formation. And it's very important to understand human well-being and so on and so forth. But there are people who are against evaluation on different counts. One is that it is like comparing, adding apples and oranges. Because the work which is done in the market is done in a different condition. It's a market condition in which profits matter, efficiency matter, and that's why the person is working in a different manner. At home, when you are doing something, you are doing in a leisurely manner. There is no, I mean, you may not, but some people can do. But the idea is that it is stretchable. It is stretchable. I mean, sometimes it's done like people like you and me or who are going out to work, we have to do it very fast also. And maybe we are more efficient in that. That's also possible. But otherwise, it's a stretchable. It can be take short time, it can be take more time, and time itself may not be enough. That's what they're arguing, and that's why it doesn't really help in valuation. Then it is also argued that when you are talking about efficiency in the market, at home, there's a lot of love and responsibility. I mean, if there is a price of efficiency, then on the other hand, you have love and efficiency. So that is something which also needs to be valued in that sense, you know, because that's something which is given, which is not given in the market. The kind of love that mother gives, the food the mother provides to the child, is not provided in the market in that sense. So this, there is a difference of that kind. So you are comparing two different systems and adding up like that, whether it is good or bad. That's something, one question which is raised. Second is that, does it have an economic value? In the sense that, does it have an exchange value? Some things can be exchanged maybe, but other things cannot be exchanged. And how do you account for that? It's not exchangeable, all unpaid work. It's not accountable. And that's why, how do you do that? How do you value? And then it's also argued that there are a large number of assumptions in this. You know, we assume that the work quality is the same. We assume that the price will be the same. And those kind of things, those assumptions in valuation are not relevant. At the same time, there are others who argue that no, valuation is important. I think we all would, I don't know what you will think about it, but I definitely believe that valuation is definitely needed. First of all, the unpaid work contributes to total well-being, and that's why it needs to be added. And what is the overall well-being of people? Secondly, it gives visibility, because right now unpaid work is non-visible. Even if it's in time accounts, it's not visible. It's not visible in data. It doesn't say as to how much unpaid work is contributing to GDP. And you cannot claim on public exchequer unless you show that you're contributing to something to that. So in order to put your claim on that, like when you are talking about productivity improvement and technology improvement in paid market, you should also think in terms of improving unpaid work in terms of technology production and so on and so forth. But you can claim that only when you can say that we are contributing 30%, 40%, 50% to the GDP, and that's why we have a claim on public exchequer and you must give that. So that's another major reason, which is a very important political reason for which we should value it. And then unpaid work has a cost. It costs, as we have seen earlier, it results in terms of depletion of human capital of women. When they are doing too much of work, there is a depletion taking place of human capital of women, and that's definitely a cost, and it's not unlimited. Women can't go on, or household members who are doing this work cannot go on and on forever. There will be a limit beyond which you cannot go. And this is one thing which is happening in HIV/AIDS case in Africa, that many other countries, that they cannot go on and on like that. There is a limit to that. And in that sense, it's an economic good, and it must be included. And lastly, it's a part of macroeconomy. Now we all know that, and that's why its dimensions need to be added. And that's why we think that valuation has importance in order to understand total macroeconomics, as well as for political reasons, that we can claim, unpaid work can claim on public exchequer. Now, this valuation is done primarily by two methods, input method and output method. Now, input method is done through valuation of labor input. What is the replacement wage rate? And here you have two kinds of wage rate. One is generalist wage rate and specialist wage rate. Now, Japan has done specialist wage rate based on information. And third is, of course, opportunity cost. So there they have used, for example, cooking. So what is the wages of cook in a restaurant? That's what they have taken. Washing, then how much the laundry in the market cost, and based on that they have used it, and that's the way they have calculated. But some other countries, like in India, we couldn't dare to do that because people would argue that the productivity is not so much at that low level, and that's why we used unskilled wage rate as the wage for valuation. So different wage rates could be used for valuation. It could be specialist wage rate. It could be unskilled wage, specialist market wage rate. It could be unskilled market wage rate. Or it could be general wage rate. For example, what is the housekeeping wage rate? How much does it cost for housekeeping in general? How much do you pay if you hire a housekeeper for doing all this work? And you can use that also. Or there is another way, and that is opportunity cost. Again, Japan and Korea both have done this, opportunity cost. Because if I'm a medical doctor, for example, and if I am doing this work, I could earn much more outside. Or if I am a highly qualified person, I could earn much more. So my opportunity cost is very high. And in order to estimate the cost, opportunity cost also is to be included, and that's why it is included. So valuation of labor input can be done in different ways. Different countries have done it in different ways. And the results also are different, therefore. You know, sometimes it comes to 30%, 40%, or sometimes it goes up to 50%, depending on what value and what kind of country situation is. Another way is of output. That input variable has one major limitation, that you are talking about labor input, but you're not talking about capital input. For example, if I'm cooking with fuel wood and try to cook some rice, etc., and if I cook on a cooking range and cook something, the technologies are different. So when you can consider the value of labor, then you have to consider labor and capital both. You just can't do just labor. And that's why they say that input method is not adequate to understand. And that's why there are people who argue for output method. And in output method, everything, whatever time uses, is converted into output. For example, cooking, how many meals produced? Childcare, how many hours childcare taken care of? So all those activities are converted into output, and the market price of that output is taken in valuation. And that's why that doesn't have the problem of stretching time. Because if I'm taking care of, if I'm cooking for meals, I may take 2 hours, I may take 1 hour, but I'm cooking a meal, and that's why the valuation can take place in that sense. So these are two major methods, but if you are talking strictly, then there are problems, conceptual problems and methodological problems in both these methods. For example, in input method, there is an assumption that there are comparable jobs in the market, and that's why you can select appropriate relevant wage rate and calculate, but it may not happen sometimes. You know, those kind of things may not exist in the market. If you are going to a non-monetized economy and there you do not have any market wage rate, and then you have to impute some market rates from outside which may not be relevant. So there are assumptions involved in this which may not be relevant. Another thing is that market non-market is not comparable, as we have seen earlier. Then market non-market work is carried out with the same capital intensity is another thing. So these are the input methods problems. And if you're using opportunity cost, there are additional problems. For example, you assume that job opportunities are available as per the qualifications. If I'm a graduate, then I have the relevant job available for me. Or if I have higher education, then I have that kind of a job available. Now, that assumption may not be relevant. If all these women go into the labor market, for example, wage rate may collapse. And that wage rate which you are valuing may not be relevant. So you are assuming that things will not change and jobs are available. Wages will not fall when the person goes into the market. We also assume that unpaid workers are well informed about the market opportunities. So all these assumptions that wage will not collapse when all these people go, or there are always jobs available, or they have full information, all these assumptions are there in opportunity cost method, which are not realistic, and that's why this method also is discarded. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, I'll have to hurry up now. But in general, one can say that output method is more important and that method is used. Now, I'm not going into the advantages of output method. Now, there is third method, which is satellite accounts method, where you go exactly the way you calculate your national income, input-output tables, and through that you calculate satellite accounts, and that is the way you do it. But this is not institutionalized in more than two countries in the world. Only 15 countries have so far calculated satellite accounts of this kind, which are matching with the national income accounts, and only two countries have done it more than once. So you can't even say that they are institutionalized, but this is something which is new happening over here. Then there are national time accounts. In order to understand how time is spent, Duncan Ironmonger, who is one of the pioneers in time use studies, has developed national time accounts. What he says is that when you can't compare apples and oranges, let's compare times. So let's see, because time is the same thing, so like prepare national time accounts. How much time is spent on SNA, how much time on non-SNA, how much on care, how much on housekeeping, how much this, etc. And that across the countries, if you have those accounts, then you can compare the different situations because that unit is the same, time unit. So he has prepared national time accounts for Australia. And he has prepared it for 2-3 times, and they had compared over time and seen as to what's happening. Then those national tech accounts, like they are like expenditure accounts, time expenditure accounts. So very simple kind of accounts. But of course, there are technical conceptual problems involved, but we are not going through that right now. And they provide information as to how people spend their time between different kinds of activities. Now, advantages of time national time accounts, as I said, you are comparing the same thing, same units. Dynamics of changes taking place in society can be measured very directly, very easily as to how much unpaid work is declining, how much paid work is increasing, and so on and so forth. Interrelations between paid and unpaid work also is examined through that, because you know how much time is spent on paid work, how much time is spent on time work, unpaid work over time. So if you have time series data, you immediately can see as to how the linkages are there. Intra-household understanding also comes into picture, how many women, how many men are paying, and over time how the shifts are taking place, whether women are spending less time on unpaid work, and so on and so forth. And socio-cultural dimensions of life also can be studied through that, and improving modeling of our economic and social systems, because you have homogeneous data, comparable data, and you can do modeling based on that, and he has tried to do that also. Now, time use also is used as well-being in indicator of well-being and poverty. Now, this is something very relevant to developing countries, and it has become very relevant in the recent times, because leisure is an indicator of well-being. Because if you have more leisure, then you are better off, but not forced leisure. There is a difference between forced leisure and leisure. So normally it is considered in that way. So one can see as to what is time stress. If there is more time stress, then you have more time poverty in terms of time poverty. And if you are feeling rushed and if you have too much work on that, then you are stressed out. You are time poor in that sense. And if you consider the poverty of time stress of the poorer sections of the population, you can estimate that very easily. Then impact of time poverty is observed in terms of depletion of well-being, depletion of human capital, depletion in the access to human capabilities, and productive economic work that forces household to adopt strategies that trap the poor in the vicious circle of time. Particularly if you're talking about lower levels, then this trap is very much there. You spend more time on your survival strategies, less time is left for human capital formation, less time is left for your participation in the labor market. That means you and your next generation also gets into the trap of poverty, and that continues. So this is something which can be understood very well. And here I think there are quite a few studies undertaken by the World Bank on time poverty, as to they have calculated time poverty in different kinds of situations in different developing countries and try to find out that. But there is one more dimension of time poverty which is very important, because it is not just time stress, but time allocation also is very important. And in that context, we have done some work as to what is the difference between time allocation of poor and non-poor in India. We have examined the time use of this, and we have observed that the way the poor are forced to allocate their time is such that their prospects to get out of poverty are very limited. For example, they have to spend a lot of time in collection of fuel, fodder, water. So they have less slime left. They are forced to spend more time on low productivity and low wage activities and those kind of things, with the result that their access to higher activities or their access to human capital formation is very less. So this limits their this thing. In other words, time allocation could be a major constraint of the poor, and that understanding of the time constraint of poor in terms of their allocation of time can help you in designing policies that will reduce their time constraint and that will help in them in getting out of poverty, and that will help in policymakers to design policies which would help them in this. So this is a new area of understanding poverty which is emerging, and a lot of people are doing. And as Rania said the other day, they have done and they are also doing another study in this area. Rania will talk more about it maybe. Then time use can be used in planning and research, planning for employment, understanding child labor, career policies, time spent on collection of fuel, fodder, water. If you're seeing that people are spending more time, children are spending more time on that, then obviously the policy would be that you provide this infrastructure and you regenerate the environment so that this water, fuel, fodder is available at the doorstep and children are able to go to school. So it has very important policy implications for human development. It has implications for employment, for women's employment, for children's employment, for gender equality, etc. Then if they are spending more time on traveling, then it has implications for transportation planning, etc. Then it has implications for gender equality, burden of work, allocation of time by men, women, intra-household, because time use provides you information about intra-household dimension of poverty and intra-household division of time. And that is something very important because we don't normally get intra-household data, and that's why this is something very important. Time use is also important for social policy designing and research, including gender inequalities. For example, issues in gender inequalities, as we said, we discussed, is intra-household inequalities, then time spent on paid and unpaid work, how much time, percentage of time is spent on unpaid work by women and how much on men. Those kind of ratios would reveal a lot about the gender inequalities. Then how much time women spend on high productivity activities and on drudgery, those ratios would provide us information about gender inequalities of different kinds. So these data could be used in different ways to understand the different dimensions of gender inequalities existing in different countries. Then pollution and its impact. This is very interesting study was conducted in USA by a scholar which tried to understand as to how much time workers spend in manufacturing industry in polluted environment. So if you have those coefficients that explain the impact of pollution on health, then larger time you spend, larger the impact you have on your health, adverse impact you will have on your health. So using the time spent on polluted environment, the study showed as that in certain industries, the impact of pollution is more, and certain industries, the impact of pollution is less. Social capital formation is another use. For example, social capital is networking. How much time you're spending networking. In our study in India, for example, it comes out that people don't have time for social networking. They don't have time to go to cooperative meetings or panchayat meetings or other kinds of meetings. So social networking is very limited. And social capital is something very important because it helps you in improving your bargaining strength in the market, and that's something which you can understand through social capital. Then problems of the old, lonely, destitute, disabled, cultural heritage and lifestyle. I think Thailand has used this data, and Thailand conducted time use surveys primarily for this in the earlier days to understand the culture and heritage, cultural heritage and lifestyle of people. Then planning for media telecasting, as we already seen. Then time use has, in other words, immense possibilities to understand socioeconomic life of people in different areas, and it's a very rich tool to understand the economy. And here I would like to mention something about the modeling which we did for understanding women's unpaid work and how employment guarantee program could improve women's condition by shifting this work to the paid work and by releasing women for something new, it's a more productive work, and by reducing the human capital depletion, for example. So this study was conducted, I'll just be very, very brief on this because we don't have time, but this study was conducted in a village in India where we understood the time use pattern. It was a SAM modeling, social accounting matrix model was prepared on the basis of the complete census data of the village of production, consumption, unpaid work, NREJ works, and so on and so forth. And then NREJ interventions were treated as an external shock on the model and multiplier impact in terms of income, production, output was calculated. And it turned out that this impact was positive and sometimes very significant. And we also calculated the impact of the unpaid work saved by women and on the model, and that also turned out to be positive, that if women are released from this, this was of course a simulation exercise because all those things are not really happening in many areas, but if women are released from unpaid work, then what kind of contribution they can make to the village economy. So those kind of things is also very important. In other words, you will realize that it's a very important tool to understand different things. Okay, for the session to get over. No, okay, fine, okay. Now, I would like to deal briefly about how do you assess the uses made of time use? I mean, we have seen immense possibilities. There are a large number of possibilities, but how many countries have used time use for these kind of things? And recently, for a book which Rania and I are editing, I had an opportunity to assess time use surveys in 56 developing countries. And on the basis of that, we found out as to why they conduct the survey, how they conduct the survey, and how they analyze and use the data. And in that, large number of insights are emerging, and I would like to talk about that in brief. Today, for example, 60 developing countries are conducting time use surveys. But many times they are small, big, good, bad surveys, but they're conducting, which is a positive development. The time use surveys are now getting more and more popular in developing countries, which is something very positive. And some uses have been made also, but these uses are not made by officials. National offices, when they produce human development report, when they produce poverty report, when they produce education, health, child labor, whatever, or when they have plans, etc., they have not used this report. But this data, what they have used is, who have used this? Primarily researchers, scholars, and some UN bodies. As I said, World Bank used this report for understanding poverty. Then UNDP also has used this data to understand poverty and to understand burden of work of women, etc. But national official governments have hardly used this data. These time use surveys are not mainstreamed. You know, out of 56 countries which we examine, only 4 countries have conducted time use survey more than once. And not, that doesn't mean that they are mainstreamed, but they have conducted more than once. Otherwise, all the countries have conducted just once. China has conducted one only recently, but large number of countries which conducted earlier time use surveys also have not repeated time use surveys. So this data, these surveys are not mainstreamed. And when you're talking about so many uses and so many things, just see the situation that time use surveys are not really so popular as such among this. And extremely limited use of data has happened. Now the question is, why is it like that? And there, I think we should understand some of the major concerns. I think first is that there is limited awareness of the uses of the data among officials and also among others, but among officials, there is a limited use of data. You know, they consider that these data are for women, how they spend their time, etc. And so they are low category data. So they don't consider this as a part of macroeconomy. They don't consider this as a part of poverty eradication strategy. They don't consider that part of employment planning. So the major macro policies, which are very important, which can have very important inputs from time use, that realization is not there. And that's why they consider this data not important enough to worry about it. I remember in one country we had gone, I don't want to mention the country, but we had gone there and we asked about, we met the NSO, National Statistical Office head, and she said that they wanted to conduct another survey. Why? Because some donor agency is giving money. And the first report was lying just like that, without even use, without even circulated widely among people. So that's the way they do, you know. They don't understand, but they think that, second thing is, you know, that donor agencies are giving money. So why not do it? So UNDP will say, okay, you conduct survey, we'll give you money. And that's why they say, okay, we'll conduct the survey. That's why a large number of countries have conducted the survey that way. And that's why felt need is not there, and that's why they're not able to appreciate and use the data. Second is limited capacity and limited funds for analysis of data. That's another reason which is given frequently. This has been done by Lauren Coriner and Jack Chalmers. Both have said that through their studies that they don't have enough funds to analyze the data, and they have limited capacity to use the data, and that's why they are not able to use the data the way we are talking about. Then it has imposed on by donor agencies. Again, they are not illustrated enough by scholars. User data not illustrated enough by scholars. Because the uses has been so scattered that policymakers are not convinced about the uses of the data. And for example, as I said in the beginning, that for estimating informal sector, many countries have entered into that because of that, but hardly any country has been able to do that. For another thing is satellite accounts or valuation of unpaid work. Very few countries have done it. Philippines, for example, tried to do this, and they tried to use their small time use survey, because they don't have a national time use survey, to calculate the value added through this time use and estimate the value contributed by unpaid work. But that was not taken seriously at all. And that's why this small little illustration was not adequate to convince the NSO in Philippines to conduct national time use survey. So they do not have any national time use survey, though several scholars have identified the uses and so on. And the NSO was headed by a woman for many years. So that is what is happening, that they are not illustrated. Another thing is that data are not up to the standard. I think this is something very important. You know, the survey design, the sampling, the time sample, the data collection methods, all these things need to be sound. And that's why one has to convince the data, the mainstream statisticians, that these data are sound enough, good enough to use. Many times they consider these data are not respected data, not good enough data, so they can't be used in the mainstream policy making. They are good for, you know, doing some small little thing here and there, but they cannot be used for using in as inputs in macro policy making. So, and this is a fact. Our survey also has brought out this thing, that there are lots of trade-offs, and that's why, for example, India. Let me give you the example of India. Now, in India, we estimated workforce participation using time-use data. We conducted time-use survey in 1999. In fact, I was heading the technical committee which designed the data and designed the survey. And after the data came out, we organized 3 international conferences. Why international? Because we wanted outside experts to come and say that these are sound methodologies and good data, because we did this survey using our funds and our expertise, and our statisticians are really capable statisticians. So we conducted this survey very well. We organized these 3 surveys. In the second survey, the first was about the methodology, which was approved by people. In second survey, we discussed application of time-use data. In one session, we had a very interesting session in which we had workforce participation rates estimated through the census of population. Second paper was workforce participation rate estimated through national sample survey. And the third was workforce participation rate estimated through time-use survey. So all the 3 papers were presented in the same session. And when NSSO people present this paper and say that our data are better than census data, everybody said, yes, NSSO is doing very well. They have been able to give good data, and that's something which is appreciated. And when Time Use Survey presented the data saying that our data are better, they were skeptical. Are they good data? Are they reliable data? Something like that. So there is a skepticism about that. You know, they are not respected enough. And that's one thing which is happening, and that's why we have not been. And the third seminar we conducted was about mainstreaming time use surveys into Indian statistical system. All the 3 surveys were coordinated by our organization with the support from CSO, of course. And in that survey, again, we brought out workshop, third seminar, workshop. Again, we brought out several experts, including Valeria and many others, to show that time use studies needs to be mainstreamed in the national statistical system. And we have put a proposal, and the proposal is now waiting with the CSO. And hopefully, as I had recently, I had a discussion with Pranab Sen, who is heading, he's chief statistician of India, and he was telling that maybe in 2010, they may consider a national time use survey, second national time use survey. It doesn't mean institutionalization, but they may do that. And we have learned lessons from the first survey and designed the whole concept and the approach which should be adopted for second time use and subsequent time use surveys in India. So this is a very slow process. It takes a lot of time. Okay, 5 minutes, fine. So this is what it is. South Africa tried to use this survey, and as people know that South Africa has not been able to use its survey to a desirable extent. Argentina, she will talk about it. Mexico, Benin. Now, the problem with Benin's study is that, you know, they collected information for time use of one day in a year. And based on that, they wanted to say that this is the time use of Benin. Nobody would agree because time sample is not representative. So these are some of the problems, you know, survey design, time sampling, data collection methods, and so on and so forth, with the result that many countries are struggling and many countries are trying to mainstream, but it's very difficult. And maybe Argentina would argue that if you use it as a modular form, you know, in a main survey, if it's a module, then next labor force survey will include it, etc. But I have some problems about the modular form, but that's a different issue altogether. I would consider independent time use survey as a very important input for a country. So finally, lessons are emerging from our 56 countries. I think first thing is that there are trade-offs in developing countries and that need to be addressed. One trade-off is that we cannot use 24-hour time use diary because people are not educated enough. They can't fill in their diary. All the countries cannot use time in minutes because watches are not available. People are not conscious about the timing. So we have to make some kind of data collection arrangement in a way that you have recall system, interview system, or stylized questions or whatever. And there are a lot of compromises take place, particularly if it's a stylized questions. In one of the Latin American countries, they collected data on how did you spend time in the last 7 days. Now, how much you can remember on that? So that is something, you know, those stylized questions is a compromise, because you don't have literacy and all those things. Another compromise is required for funds. Adequate funds are not available. Your sample size is small. Your data collection expenditure is less. You have to use shortcuts and so on and so forth. Third is your capabilities. In developing countries, capabilities also is an issue. So they think that let's have shortcuts, let's have do this. So we do that kind of a thing also. And then availability of standard concepts and methods at global level also is a very important limitation, that we have not been able to develop standard concepts and methods on this. Now, several guidebooks have been written by different things. For example, UNSCAP, we produced a guidebook on time use. ECA Africa, they have come out with a guidebook. ECLAC is also doing something. UNST had 2-3 meetings to standardize classification, etc. But all these works are works in progress. Nothing has been completed so far. So we do not have, at present, as of now, we do not have standard concepts, methods, classification, etc., available at the global level. And that's also one of the reasons why these data are not respected by several conservative statisticians. Then there is a need to develop a strategy for expanding and mainstreaming time use in national statistical system. And that strategy should be based on creating awareness, competence, and to establish its utility and create demand. Because unless you have a demand, nothing happens. So if you are able to demand, if you go out to a statistical officer and say that we want to conduct this survey, they will not listen to you. They said, what is this nonsense? But if you say, if you use the data, you have better policy for policy reduction. If you have used the data, you can plan employment better. All those things, if you can show, then the demand will be created and that they will be able to convince. So that kind of use needs to be established. And there is, of course, no one-size-fits-all model. There are alternative models. There is no doubt about it. But what is important is that in none of these models, quality should be compromised. That's my belief. Because unless you have rigorous data, acceptable for macro policy formulation, time-use data will not be able to make much impact in terms of macro policy formulation or monetary macro policy formulation. Global organizations can play a very important role, and I think here UNST, ILO, and UNDP can definitely play a very important role. Apart from the regional UN offices, there is a need. So I would like to conclude by saying that uses are immense, possibilities are immense. They are very relevant to developing countries, and we can definitely make a lot of sense out of it, and we can improve our policymaking in different dimensions, starting from micro to micro. But and a lot is achieved, but a lot more needs to be achieved, and a lot more needs to be done in terms of many things. Thank you.